You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respects to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. Today is Tuesday, the 4th of November, 2025. And thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear, peace and energy issues. My name is Fung and I've got Fiza in the studio with me this morning. Good morning.
Hey, morning. It's good to be back.
Yes, good to have you back. And for listeners who obviously cannot see us today, we're each wearing a Free Palestine jumper.
Hey, solidarity.
Yeah. Mine's a black and white one and Faze's got an amazing, is it white or cream color?
Yeah.
With like Free Palestine in rainbow colors.
Yeah, I like
with a
it.
Rainbow.
It throws people off because I think people tend to think like, oh, like, you know, the Free Palestine crowd.
Yeah, they're
like
their
scary.
Own. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, rainbow.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
How have you been, Faze? What's going on this weekend? Did you get to do anything? What have you been up to?
Oh, wow. I was at the Sunday rally.
Yeah.
And which was a beautiful day, sunny, gorgeous, great speakers. And because we've switched to monthly, so we had quite a fair lineup of speakers, which was great. But this is just not political at all, but maybe it is. The pollen trees.
The
plane trees.
The plane trees.
The pollen was just, you could see it through the sky. And I'm like, I think that's enough for like class action against Melbourne City Council.
No,
to
definitely.
Be like, this is actually deadly. Like people were struggling to breathe. It was crazy.
Well, because they're not native.
They're not. Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah. No, yeah. Definitely. I feel like, I don't normally get hay fever, but sometimes depending on what the weather's been like, if it's been really wet and then dry or windy, it's really
place.
Bad. But especially along, you know, St Kilda Road and in the CBD.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Exactly. It's just lines of the streets. We're thinking it's very anti-protest of them because it's literally the protest.
For sure, yeah.
Route.
No, definitely.
So I'm like,
Well, I would love to have someone on to talk about.
Right? Because I think there was talk
species.
At one point about, yeah, exactly, like removing the plane trees in the CBD because exactly they're an introduced species. And but I don't know, nothing came out of that because there was at one point like a movement.
Well, there's two members of this movement right here.
right now. Yeah, I'm committed.
So if anyone is listening and knows anything about plane trees and how we can potentially have them removed for various reasons. Yeah, please get in touch with the Tuesday Breakfast Show. I've been doing like a deep clean. My partner and I have been doing a deep clean of our house.
Yeah.
It happens once a year.
Satisfying.
And it is satisfying.
Yeah.
Yeah, but do you ever have this thing where you're like cleaning and you're like, oh, there's that thing that I haven't seen in a while. And you're like, do I really need it if I forgot?
Turns out, yeah, that's
it
true.
Existed.
Yeah.
Lots
of op shops drop-offs.
Some op shop drop-offs. And, just also having, like, speaking of protests, just having come across posters that I had, you know, like from maybe like 2 years ago.
Wow. Like when,
we first started weekly.
Yeah.
And also, just like hand-painted signs, which is kind of cool.
That's cool,
like,
yeah.
It's like
you
your own personal,
keep those. Exactly.
Personal
yeah.
archive of
yeah,
things. But,
definitely.
Also, you know, just living in an apartment and the amount of space that you don't
it's
have
limited, yeah.
for things. Yeah. But that's been satisfying and that will be an ongoing task
process? Okay.
For today. But for now, let's talk about what is coming up on today's show.
Yeah, so at 7:15 a.m. We will be speaking to Karen. We'll be listening to Karen Fletcher and Luisa Bassini for the Standing Together for Public Housing campaign. On Thursday, 23rd October, at the Standing Together for Public Housing meeting, speakers from a range of community organizations spoke out to protect public housing in Victoria, including Karen Fletcher from Flat Out and Luisa Bassini from Inner Melbourne Community Legal. And then at 7:30 a.m., we'll have Lisa Schindler from Australian Marine Conservation Society speaking with Julia. Dr. Lisa Schindler is a marine ecologist working with the Australian Marine Conservation Society, protecting the Great Barrier Reef, basically, from damaging deforestation.
And at 7:45, continuing our discussion of public housing, we'll be joined by Kerry Byrne, who is a member of the Save Public Housing Collective, and she'll be on the show to talk about the ongoing community pickets to save public housing at 12 Holland Court, Flemington. There'll be pickets happening Wednesday, Thursday, Friday this week from 7 to 9am. So we'll be chatting to her about that. At 8 o'clock, we'll be joined by Nat, who is an educator, researcher and grassroots community organiser. She's also the co-founder of In Praxis Collective. And Nat will be joining us on the show to talk about the demilitarisation movement, as well as a new demilitarisation resource repository that people can access and contribute to, which contains like articles, reports, audio websites and more, if people want to learn more about the industrial military complex. And finally, at 8:50, we'll be joined by Matilda Fay, who is a member of the Refugee Action Coalition in Sydney, and she'll be speaking to us about what happened last week, which was the Albanese government deporting someone from the NZYQ cohort, first deportation to Nauru under the government's new secret offshore deal. So we'll be chatting about that at 8:15. So that is our show for this morning. Stay tuned. We'll be back with the news headlines after this.
Some folks know about it, some don't. No. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty, say you're gonna
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 4th of November, 2025. A senior Sudanese diplomat has accused the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, of committing war crimes in the country's North Darfur state, as survivors who escaped the city of Al-Fashir recounted mass killings and sexual assault by the paramilitary troops. Sudan's ambassador to Egypt, Imadeldin Mustafa Adawi, made the allegations on Sunday as he accused the United Arab Emirates of helping the RSF paramilitary group in the ongoing civil war. The Gulf state denies the claim. Adawi's remarks followed an earlier statement by Sudanese Prime Minister Kamil Idris, who told the Swiss newspaper Blick that the RSF should be tried in the international courts. But Kamil rejected the quite illegal idea of foreign troops being deployed to his country, which has been ravaged by civil war between the RSF and the Sudanese army since April 2023. The calls for action come a week after the RSF seized the capital of North Darfur, Al-Fashir, after an 18-month siege and starvation campaign, resulting in thousands of reported civilian deaths. The city was the Sudanese army's last stronghold in the region. Also in the news, Footscray Community Response, or FCR, are opposing the decision by Maribyrnong Council to employ private security guards to accompany bylaw officers to enforce new and concerning local laws in central Footscray. FCR are demanding that Maribyrnong Council make a public commitment to discontinue the security guard program once the trial ends in January, and to instead invest in community-led health and wellbeing solutions for social problems in Footscray. FCR are pushing for culturally responsive and community-based solutions to community safety, such as justice reinvestment, which redirect funds towards local services addressing the underlying causes of crime. They reject current framings of unhoused, drug-affected and disadvantaged people as antisocial or a danger to others, and oppose policies that over-police, racially profile or dehumanise them because of government policy failures. Footscray Community Response spokesperson and community lawyer Shifra Bluestein shared that the Footscray community wants to see compassionate, evidence-based responses to social problems. The evidence is clear that approaches to social issues that target and dehumanise people drive the very behaviours that council claim to be concerned about.
In other news, Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian in Gaza despite a United States brokered ceasefire, bringing the toll since the truce to 236, as Hamas handed over the remains of three more captives. Medics said on Sunday that the Palestinian man was killed in an Israeli drone attack on the Shujaya neighborhood of Gaza City, where Israeli forces have been carrying out building demolitions since the morning. The Israel military said the man had crossed the yellow line, marking the ceasefire boundary, and approached its troops without offering evidence. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, Israeli forces have killed at least 236 Palestinians and wounded 600 others since the ceasefire took effect last month. It said the bodies of 502 Palestinians have also been retrieved from under the rubble of destroyed homes and buildings since the truce, taking the overall death toll from Israel's genocide to 68,856 people. Finally, in the headlines, leading Australian psychiatrists have joined a growing chorus of criticism against the Northern Territory's prison and justice systems, warning that the government's punitive approach is deepening cycles of trauma and crime rather than reducing them. Lawyers, medical professionals and Aboriginal-controlled community organisations gathered in Alice Springs last week for a symposium hosted by the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. They argued the Territory's pro-incarceration policies that were introduced under the guise of community safety are having the opposite effect. Since coming into power last year, the Country Liberal Party has overhauled the justice system, lowering the age of criminal responsibility to 10 years old, reintroducing spit hoods in youth detention, expanding mandatory sentencing, and announcing plans to arm public safety officers, a move that has been criticised as a deeply irresponsible escalation. This have been the news headline for Tuesday, 4th November 2025. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
On Thursday, 23rd October, at the Standing Together for Public Housing meeting, speakers from a range of community organisations spoke out to protect public housing in Victoria. Karen Fletcher from Flat Out, who joined our show 2 weeks ago in advance of the rally, spoke about imprisonment numbers of women in Victoria, the privatisation and commercialisation of public housing, and the lack of support for community organisations like Flat Out, who are doing on-the-ground work to keep women out of prison. The second speaker is Louisa Bassini from Inner Melbourne Community Legal, who discusses the haste with which the demolition was proposed and the work that her organisation is doing to represent residents of the tower.
Hi, my name's Karen Fletcher. I work at Flat Out. Flat Out is a community organisation, and we've heard that word community used a lot tonight. And I'll be talking about it a lot more in my speech. But our organisation's been going for now 37 years. It started in the heyday of feminist activism, and we are a group that supports women, trans and gender diverse people and their kids when they get out of prison. We still have the same number of workers that we had 37 years ago when we first got funded, which is 2.6 full-time equivalent to 2.6. Over time, we've had a little bit of money here and there from the odd philanthropic and maybe a year or two of some sort of pilot program. But as a community organisation, we are infinitesimally small. At the same time, the prison system in Victoria has expanded beyond all expectation. We reached a top of 600 women in the women's prison a few years ago. At the moment, it went down over COVID. At the moment, we've got 400 women there, but it's on its way back up again with these regressive changes to the bail laws. But the state government, whilst it's cutting its expenditure on public housing and has become the lowest provider of public housing in the country, has been absolutely massively expanding the prison system. By $3 billion in just the 2018 to two financial years from 2018 to 2020, with the building of the Western Plains prison, the massive over 1,000 cell Western Plains prison, and the prison for children at Cherry Creek, but expansions of all the prisons, including the women's prison. And this massive expenditure, as I said, comes at the same time as all of this concern about not wanting to spend public money on public housing and starting to do... I mean, we've been asking... Every speaker has been asking, why? Why is this happening in Victoria? Why is... And I just wanted to put forward a couple of explanations because I think... from our perspective, what we see is that this is about privatisation. The word community has come out of community housing. The community is a great word. Community legal centre, community radio, community football, community health. But this community, in this community housing, and who are using words that we used to use, like unity and housing first and housing choices, and these are massive, massive pro-development, real estate conglomerates, private equity and banks. I just saw the other day when we were going to... We get a vote in the Homelessness Australia board, and there were 9 or 10 candidates. I think one of the candidates was from the ANZ Bank. This is what's happening. We community organisations, we got 2.6 workers trying to get women and children housed. you know, when there's just 3 nights in a motel from our colleagues in the community housing, trying to house people in the community housing sector. Sorry, I've lost my train of thought. Well, 2.6 workers there, but we're expected to be able to, the community sector, to be able to compete with banks and private equity firms. We have to do tenders. We have to do return on investment calculations. I wouldn't know a return on investment calculation if I fell over it. And we've got 2.6 workers who are busy trying to get people housed. But that's the only way to get this money. That's why this is all conglomerated. These, what used to be great things, community organisations and cooperatives and all the things that we want and love, have conglomerated and conglomerated and conglomerated into these massive companies and corporations and interests. And they're coming from overseas now when they can see that this land is available, and the land that these 44 public housing towers are on, prime inner city land. And they can do what they did at Walker Street. If people know Walker Street, the public housing walk-up, which was in my neighbourhood, which is now called Merry, and now has luxury housing on the river, a tiny little strip of public housing along the edge of it, and so-called affordable housing in between. But those luxury apartments on the river, they just break my heart every time I pass them in the tram. That used to be public housing. That used to be a real community. So I wanted to talk about community. I've run out of time, but community is the thing that keeps us safe. Not prisons, not police. It's community. And these communities are being destroyed, and it's unsafe. It has to stop. Together for public housing, we need to talk to each other, including tonight and in the future. How do we get the unions involved? How do we get ourselves organised so that we're talking to each other? If we want to be safe, we truly want a safe and good community, we have to build actual communities, not let the banks take us over.
From the outset, the demolition detailed in the Labor government's housing statement has been obvious in its aims to clear out the inner city of public housing. At our service, we'd assisted residents in previous public housing renewal programs that had their share of problems, but this program was a clear departure from the past, both in the scale of the planned destruction of the 44 towers and the haste with which the program proceeded. We commenced the class action, made possible with the courage of residents like Barry, to test the lawfulness of the decision. As lawyers representing many of the residents of the towers who had not been consulted with or even warned of the decision, we asked Homes Victoria from the start, where was the evidence that the charter rights of our clients had been considered, as any public authority like it is required to? We also asked for evidence that the proposal was the least restrictive on the rights of residents in achieving its objectives. That is, was there another, fairer approach to dealing with the state of repair of the towers? In the course of legal proceedings, it was identified that there were documents, a cabinet submission, that formed the basis of the demolition decision. When we asked to see those documents, Homes Victoria claimed public interest immunity over them, resulting in them remaining confidential. Although we lost the case in the Supreme Court, we have brought an appeal, as Judge Bell said, to the decision, and the case will be heard in the Court of Appeal on Monday. Please come and show your support if you're able to. It will really, really help. In the meantime, we attend meetings together with clients and Homes Victoria, where the residents who remain in the towers face immense pressure to move to homes that aren't suitable to them. To sit in an office below a family's home and have a government representative say that the family can't remain in their suburb because there are no homes available that are big enough for them, while a home of that exact size is above us, in good condition, is truly surreal. To request a right of return for families to their rebuilt homes and to have that same representative assure us that will be possible, even though we know that no public housing is set to be rebuilt on the estates, is staggering. You get to see that this isn't at all about homes for people, but rather a pivotal moment in the attempted dismantling of the public housing system of this state. Thanks.
That was Karen Fletcher from Fled Out and Louisa Bassini from Inner Melbourne Community Legal speaking at the meeting Standing Together for Public Housing, which took place on Thursday, 23rd October. Up next, we have a song for you. This is A Jojoba by Fairtrade Narcotics, a psychedelic jazz group based in Nam.
Dusk paints the fading sky, sun drenched and wasting light. Into the sands we dwell, into the early night. Dusk paints the
Jojoba by Fairtrade Narcotics, a psychedelic jazz group based in Nam. Up next, Julia recently spoke with Dr. Lisa Schindler, a marine ecologist working with the Australian Marine Conservation Society, about protecting the Great Barrier Reef from damaging deforestation. Lisa discusses the impact of the 700,000 over vegetation clearing within reef catchments in Queensland and its tragic effects upon the ecosystem of the Great Barrier Reef.
I mentioned a report to look into deforestation in reef catchments. So catchments are areas that drain into rivers and creeks that then run out into the waters of the Great Barrier Reef. And when you clear trees, you're basically creating bigger erosion problems, which then washes more soil out into the waters of the Great Barrier Reef. And in Queensland, there's been a really big problem with deforestation, and especially, you know, half of that deforestation that's happening is in Queensland Great Barrier Reef catchments. Mm-hmm. And so this report that we released, it's been updated yearly, looking at if there's been any improvement in clearing, and just to really get a sense of the extent and the location of where the clearing is happening. And the report found that there's been huge amounts of clearing, so almost 700,000 hectares, which is about three times the size of the ACT. So that's a really big amount of land that's been cleared over those 4 years. The report also found that, you know, 70,000 hectares is along riverbanks. So that's really concerning, because those are the really critical areas that you need to be stabilising those riverbanks to stop the soil running in. Trees play a really important role stabilising that soil. And, so we released it. It's pretty worrying about it, but there's also this opportunity at the moment that the federal government is reviewing its federal laws for the environment, and there's an opportunity that they could actually act and help stop this problem.
Right, yeah. Hopefully that creates some change, because, it's super devastating what's happening. I was also looking at the photos that were released of the deforestation. It's interesting because I feel like we don't really hear about this happening like very often. So I was really shocked to hear how much has been cut down. And it's really surprising that it's legal as well, I was thinking.
I think that's the thing, is that of the, I think it's 682,000 hectares that's been cleared, 80% of that is actually legal. Which means that there's huge loopholes in our law that amount of native vegetation can actually be cleared. And that's just in Great Barrier Reef catchments, not across the whole of Queensland.
Wow. And I suppose it's bizarre that that's actually legal. Because, there's a certain loophole that's occurred.
There's two. So the state laws were strengthened in 2018, mm-hmm. and there's this thing called Category X that they've classified different native vegetation as. And if a farmer or any landowner in history has cleared that area, then they've marked it on a map and identified it that they want to clear it in the future. And therefore you can't actually protect that area. So that's the sort of state loophole. But then at the federal level, these areas are not actually looked at under federal law. So they've been exempt through this really old, they call it a grandfather clause, that when the original environmental laws came in 2000, that this was sort of a loophole in that law as well. So you've not only got it at the state level where it's, you know, it's legally to clear, the federal laws are not picking it up either and assessing it. So what the federal government can do is that they can get rid of this grandfathering clause that they've got in the federal environment laws, and that would really solve like a big part of this problem, because a lot of that vegetation, some of it is 20 years old. And so you're thinking like, this is not just rubbish vegetation that's weeds and things that have, you know, that they're clearing every year. Some of this is really significant forests that are just being knocked down. And so this is really why we're calling on the federal government to step in and protect these areas. And it's not just about, you know, obviously this, so when you have the soil running out into the waters of the Great Barrier Reef, you're murking up the water, and corals and seagrass need clean, clear water to survive. But it's also a climate change issue. So when you clear trees, you're releasing carbon out into the atmosphere. So you've got this double whammy of impacts that the clearing is having.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's interesting because, and it's great that you're promoting awareness of this and speaking about your research, because I think like just using my like own knowledge of science, like I guess science, I wouldn't necessarily connect like forest clearing to affect the ocean, like, so it's so interesting how like it's all interconnected, and like protecting the forest is simultaneously protecting the ocean and the rivers.
Yeah, and I think people, when they think of the Great Barrier Reef, they just think of the coral, but it's like massive ecosystems that are all connected. And so the second biggest threat to the Great Barrier Reef is actually water pollution coming from runoff on land. And that, you know, that's coming from land that's not within the actual waters of the Great Barrier Reef. So it's all connected. And when you don't just need to put in marine parks and protect areas in the Great Barrier Reef, you also need to be protecting things on land in the catchment. So restoring wetlands, making sure that you're not really clearing in those areas, because everything has an impact. And the Great Barrier Reef is under such huge stress at the moment through climate change that the governments need to be doing everything they can to be elevating all the other threats to the reef.
Yeah, oh, 100%. And hopefully, like, with more environmental, like, awareness and awareness of climate change, hopefully the laws will eventually adapt to meet this as well. And I also had the question, do you know what the clearing, like, is generally being used for?
Yeah, a large, like, the majority of the clearing is for agriculture.
Agriculture, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really centered around, so it's happening through a lot of the catchment. So the Great Barrier Reef is huge, so it's, you know, 2,300 kilometres. It's about two-thirds of the Queensland coast. So it's a massive area, but a large part, I think it's about 82% of the clearing is actually happening in central Queensland around the Fitzroy, in the Fitzroy area, the river there, and then just in north Queensland, kind of around the Burdekin, which is near Townsville.
Yeah, wow, it's sad. Yeah, and that brings up a whole nother conversation, I guess, of, yeah, how can we improve, like, the agriculture system and, like, like, grow things sustainably rather than on, like, a mass level.
Yeah, and you've got groups like the Wilderness Society who do a lot of awareness raising around deforestation-free beef. Because a lot of this is from grazing.
Oh, wow. And, okay, interesting.
Yeah, and so they run things, and I know that there was I saw in the media today that one of the banks, I think it was Westpac, had sort of gone back a bit on their commitments to stop funding, trying to look at deforestation in their project funding. So there's other ways that you can do it. Not, you know, obviously right now we have an opportunity under the federal laws to make a difference in that, in closing that loophole. But there's other ways that consumers themselves can do it by checking, like, if you do eat meat or things, like, where it's coming from.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, knowing, yeah, where it's coming from, the source, that's always important. It's like, business. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's, yeah, interesting. And I guess it's also, yeah, it's so sad to think that it's, like, also affecting, yeah, the marine life as well. And also, I guess, like, in the great, just out of curiosity as well, in the Great Barrier Reef, I guess to snorkel and, like, go into the Great Barrier Reef, do you think you would actually notice that there's the coral has less colour? Like, is the results of this kind of obvious?
Through the sediment, the
soil. Yeah,
definitely. It really impacts especially areas that are close to shore. So we call them inshore reefs. But it can, like, when we have big flood events, it can go out to the mid-shelf and even outer-shelf reefs, so really far out. When we have these big flood events. So there was one of those in Townsville at the start of the year, and there's this really this image that just shows this big sediment plume reaching really like 100 kilometres out into the waters of the Great Barrier Reef. So, and, you know, as climate change worsens, we're going to have more of these extreme weather events and we're going to be seeing it getting out more. And it changes the water clarity. So you know, coral reefs are known for their crystal clear waters, but when you have this kind of sediment coming in, it just makes the water murky, and coral and seagrass need light to grow and to survive. And when it reduces the light, then they can't do that. And ultimately certain species do die if you can't get the water clean.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. Yeah. And yeah, that would be such a tragedy. Like, it's such a special sacred place. So yeah, it's really, really important to speak about this. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you so much.
It's okay.
Yeah. I think that should be okay. For,
okay.
Yeah. Unless do you have, is there anything else you would like to say as well?
I mean, the only other thing is that, you know, the World Heritage Committee has been assessing the management of the Great Barrier Reef for multiple years now, and next year Australia has to submit what they call a state of conservation report to sort of show the World Heritage Committee what they're doing and how they're improving their management. And right now there hasn't really been huge improvements in what they're doing, but this is an opportunity for the government to actually make a difference and reduce deforestation in Great Barrier Reef catchments. It's been a really big concern of the World Heritage Committee for multiple years. They've been calling on Australia to improve and strengthen the laws. So this would go a long way in helping to keep the Great Barrier Reef off the World Heritage in danger list.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so it's not currently on the World
Heritage. It's not, no. It has for the second time in a row, though, it's been listed as critical by the IUCN, who are the scientific advisors to the World Heritage Committee. And the Great Barrier Reef is the only site that has been listed multiple times as critical and not been put on the World Heritage in danger list. So, you know, every year there's a higher risk that it will. And if Australia doesn't do more and sort of up its game in managing these threats, then it will eventually end up on that list. And then there's a whole other suite of things that Australia will need to do. And obviously the tourism industry are quite worried about that, because they're worried that tourists won't come if they, you know, this site is listed as a World Heritage in danger site.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it affects so many systems and so many, yeah, I think one thing that affects nature affects all of us in so many different ways.
Yeah, and there was that report that came out last week that showed that the Great Barrier Reef is actually the seventh biggest employer in Australia.
Wow.
In terms of how many jobs it provides. So, you know, it's not just this amazing ecosystem, because it's the, you know, the world's biggest living organism.
Yeah.
But it's also this huge economic powerhouse that's bringing in billions to the economy every year as well. So even if, you know, people, are not interested in biodiversity and its unique natural benefits, it's this economic as well, and for regional areas as well, it's always harder to find employment in those kind of regional areas.
That was an interview between Julia and Lisa Schindler as Lisa discusses the impact of mass forest clearing within Queensland upon the Great Barrier Reef, and she calls for the government to take action and strengthen environmental laws that allow for this to occur. Up next, we have another song for you. This is Social Street, an up-and-coming soul-funk duo, and this is their new single titled He Gets Me High.
Till I'm hedging my bets on you. See how long till I'm hedging my bets on you. See how long till I'm hedging my bets on you.
And that was the song He Gets Me High by Social Street. We are now joined by Kerry Byrne, who is a member of the Save Public Housing Collective and also a long-time public tenant. She has been engaged in issues around the privatisation of the public housing system for many years. And Kerry joins us on the show this morning to talk about the ongoing community pickets to save public housing at 12 Holland Court in Flemington. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Kerry.
Good morning, Fong. Good morning, listeners.
Thank you so much for joining us. So we've talked on 3CR across various different programs about the ongoing fight to save public housing, but you're here specifically to talk about what's happening at 12 Holland Court. So can you start by speaking to us about these community pickets that are taking place? I know that they will be continuing this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in the morning.
That's right. Don't bother going down there today unless you just want to check out the estate. There won't be any pickets today, but it will be happening for the rest of the work week. That's Wednesday to Friday. The morning picket is 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and then the afternoon one is 4:30 to 6:30. And where they're happening is basically on the corner of Racecourse Road and Holland Court. So that's the top end, the north end of the Flemington high-rise public housing estate. And look, if you've got a sign about saving public housing, please bring it along. But I think the organisers have got a few spare signs as well. And look, we know it's hard. People are working and so on. But, you know, even if you can spare half an hour, we don't expect people to stay the entire duration, but just whatever you can manage. Mm-hmm. And there's coffee and tea and so forth.
Yeah. And can you talk a bit about the atmosphere at the pickets? Like, for people who perhaps have never been to one before, what can they expect?
Well, really, it's just a bunch of people holding signs. We get a lot of appreciative toots from the commuters going past, so that's always great. But the other thing is that it's given the organisers, more communication, more proximity to the residents inside that particular building. And can I just talk a bit about what's actually going on inside the building at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. Go for it, Kerry.
Yeah, okay. So we've termed it pre-demolition construction zone. So basically, even though there's still one or two handfuls of resident households at 12 Holland Court, there's works going on inside the building. They're drilling and there's other kinds of works going on as well. And I've seen photographs of all of this. So basically, they seem to be fortifying the building so that squatters can't occupy it once the remaining residents have moved out. So I've seen pictures of sort of steel-reinforced door frames and elaborate sort of opening and closing mechanisms. So that's what we think's going on. They're spending money on that sort of thing when they can't even fix up broken public housing. You know, there's no money to fix public housing, but there's money to do these very strange Orwellian building works. So as part of that, you know, obviously it's impacting on the residents. Fortunately, the person who's been documenting all this has some building expertise. So there's been, you know, OH&S incidents, things like power cupboards being left open, but a lot more serious than that, and this is all being documented. And also, a week ago, I think it was Monday last week, the lifts in the building were out for practically the whole day, you know, more than 5 hours, and so, of course, the residents couldn't take their kids to school. It's a 20-storey building, bear in mind, right?
Yeah.
And so the residents couldn't take their kids to school, and I also understand that one resident was, they couldn't use their insulin pump for all that time until I think Homes Victoria brought them a power bank eventually. So that was another serious incident arising from these works going on inside the building before the residents have left. So if I can just talk a bit more about the impact on residents.
Yeah, definitely. Just quickly, Kerry, it just sounds like it's such a... There's so much dehumanization going on. Like, I feel like everything that you've described from the architecture, you know, the building reinforcements or whatever they're building to stop
whatever
people from squatting, yeah. But also the fact that, like you said, there's no money or resources being put to support residents there, the fact that the lifts were out, the fact that people couldn't access medical equipment, it's just a very, dehumanizing approach. And it's just something that you keep seeing, right, in terms of there's always money to, you know, for things like weapons and prisons and police, but never any money for community health and well-being. But please continue with the effects and how this is impacting residents.
Okay, so you may be aware that there was a class action which unfortunately the residents lost. They believed that they asserted that Homes Victoria hadn't considered their human rights when they made this decision to demolish the three towers. That's two at Flemington and one at North Melbourne. That class action is... The decision of that class action is currently being appealed, and because of that, Homes Victoria formally agreed not to issue notice to vacates until a decision has been handed down. Now, my understanding is that a few residents had received eviction notices, but as I said, they're cancelled now. And I would say, just in case you're wondering, while I don't have personal experience of the people who were handed eviction notices, what I'm aware of is from the Barrack Beacon Port Melbourne estate, when that was all needlessly demolished, the people who were left at the end were there not because they were actively resisting, but because they hadn't been offered suitable properties, right? Mm. So I'd say that's why those people were there. And then there were other people in that building we know who have been offered properties that they've accepted, but they're just waiting for those properties to be ready. Now, I want to stress that one of those residents, and I'm personally aware of this incident, 10 days ago, even though this resident had accepted an offer of a specific property, and they're just waiting for the property, for the power to be connected to all that, they were actually threatened with having their locks replaced at 12 Holland Court. And obviously this was a major drama, and it took, friends and activists quite a long time to negotiate with Homes Victoria before finally in the evening they backed down. That was just, a very weird but obviously very traumatising incident for the resident, yeah.
Yeah, that's so incredibly stressful. Everything just about this ongoing issue, from the eviction notices or the lack of communication to very extreme measures that you have just described there, which I guess just stresses how important it is to get people down to the pickets this week to stand in solidarity with the residents at 12 Holland Court, Flemington. Before we end the interview today, Kerry, is there anything else you wanted to say just in terms of what we're seeing with public housing across the state?
Yeah, look, Homes Victoria is an entity that's been imposed on the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing. And my understanding is that there are also, you know, bureaucrats with or public servants within the department who agree with me that this reckless decision-making will only subside when Homes Victoria is abolished and the business of running public housing goes back within the government firmly. Mm. You know, Homes Victoria has an external board of directors and we don't really know. It's all very opaque, right? We
yeah.
don't. We're not really across the advice that the board is giving the minister. And can I just explain the landscape, or are we running out of time? Basically, five towers will be demolished initially. That's the two red brick towers at Carlton, and they're the only two that will be replaced with genuine public housing. So the rest of the 44 towers across Melbourne, well, unless the government makes decision to keep on managing public housing. But so far we think, so far the two at Flemington will, once they're rebuilt, they're going to be rebuilt by the consortium, which is headed up by Community Housing Limited, under the ground lease model, which means that consortium leases the estates from the government for 40 years and a huge expense, you know. Usually when you're a tenant, you pay the landlord, right?
Yep.
But in this case, the government is the landlord and they're paying the consortium to do the construction, that's fair enough, but also to manage the properties. And we believe that obviously it would be far more effective if it was constructed and managed as public housing. Mm. And just finally, those first five towers, two at Flemington, one at North Melbourne, and the two Carlton red brick ones, they'll all be demolished by John Holland, and there's a $100 million contract for that.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Kerry. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I think this definitely warrants another conversation, I think, to go into this in more detail. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast to talk about what's happening in Flemington specifically.
Yeah, and please, everybody, get down to the pickets at 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the morning or 4:30 in the afternoon.
Thanks so much, Kerry.
Cheers, bye.
That was Kerry Byrne from the Save Public Housing Collective. And as Kerry just mentioned, there are pickets running on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday of this week from 7 to 9 a.m. and then from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. For more information, you can follow the group on Instagram at Save Public Housing Collective, or you can visit their website at savepublichousing.com. We'll be back with our next segment after a couple of messages.
The annual Melbourne Pacifica Festival is on again, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday, December the 6th, at the playground end of Banjo Paterson Park in Lynbrook. Immerse yourself in the richness of Pacific Island culture with traditional dance, dynamic drumming, soulful harmonies, bands, guest artists, children's activities including rugby clinics, Pacifica arts and crafts, and yummy food. Lots of fun and activities for the whole family. Saturday, December the 6th in Lynbrook. Visit melbournepacificafestival.org. Melbourne Pacifica Festival is a 3CR supporter.
The
LGBTIQA+ Multicultural Fair Day will be held in the city of Whittlesea this year. Funded by Whittlesea City Council and auspiced by Australian LGBTIQA+ Multicultural Multifaith Council, the fair will have a strong human rights, social justice focus as experienced through an intersectional lens. The event is held in a safe, supportive, inclusive space consisting of art and skills-based workshops by Street Art Doyle Blender Studio, African drumming, recycled fashion and sustainable gardening, information stalls, food and giveaways. The LGBTIQA+ Multicultural Fair Day, Saturday, November 8th, 3:30 till 7:30 p.m. at the Barry Road Community Activity Centre, 36 Barry Road, Thomastown. On-site parking available, entry is free and all are welcome. Whittlesea City Council is a 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR Community Radio. That's 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. And we are now joined on the phone by Nat, who is an educator, researcher and grassroots community organiser. She's also the co-founder of In Praxis Collective, which is a collective committed to liberation and justice through praxis. Nat joins us to talk about the demilitarisation movement, as well as a new demilitarisation resource repository containing articles, reports, audio and other documents to help people better understand and fight against the industrial military complex. Welcome back to 3CR, Nat.
Thanks for having me.
To start off with, can you explain to our listeners what In Praxis Collective is in more detail and how it formed?
In Praxis Collective started, I think it was February 2024, and it was at a time when we were just feeling a lot of repression and restrictions in terms of all the kinds of work that we were doing, both within the academic space and outside of it as well. And we just really felt like there wasn't a space for us to be able to have conversations, to engage with different ways of thinking, raising different kinds of questions, particularly at a time when there was the renewed onslaught of genocide against Palestinian people. And so we created a space for us to just be able to come together and to engage with one another and to really think about how all of the different threads that we're kind of part of, how we can weave them together collectively and how we can do that in ways that exist outside of these kinds of silos that we're often restricted to in our work and our study.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing to consider, is the fact that we are put into silos and we are forced to, you know, keep apart, like the many ways in which the state tries to do that to stop people from coming together, to build solidarity, to build movements. I know that In Praxis has a slow reading series. Can you talk a bit about that and what slow reading entails?
Yeah, so I guess one of the things that we felt was missing in a lot of the spaces that we were part of was a space for us to just be really generous with one another and slow with one another in the way that we're thinking about things and engaging with things. And so we started the slow reading series where we kind of come together and we read something together and there's no pre-reading required, so it's like a reading group, but you don't have to have come to any breedings before and you don't have any obligation to come to any after. And we also just pick a variety of resources to read. So it could be blog posts, essays, just a chapter from a book rather than a whole book. And the idea is that we read that piece together and we pause in sections and we have conversations about that as they emerge. And there's no expectation for us to ever finish a reading either. And it really just slows down that process and it creates the conditions for us to be able to be in dialogue with one another and to be like thinking in a more, I guess, live way with one another. And that creates the conditions for us to converse and to kind of open up our kind of critical thinking in different ways that are not always available.
Yeah, well, you know, if they are made available, it's through institutions like universities, which can sometimes be very limited or prescriptive in the way that they want people to read and think, and it's also very exclusive. It's not accessible to everyone. So why is it so important to have spaces like this that exist outside of, universities and other institutions?
Yeah, I think that was really important to us at the beginning, that we wanted a space where people outside of academic context could access as well. Like, this is not work that's restricted to the academic realm and it shouldn't be. And so we wanted to create a space where people from all different backgrounds and different lines of work, different lines of whatever it is that they're involved in, can come to this space and can be in conversation with one another. It creates a much richer conversation than speaking to people that looking at something through a particular lens, say an academic lens. And it also, because of the style of it, it means that nobody has, I guess, any pre-formulated thoughts about the resource that we're engaging with. And so it kind of diffuses any kind of, I guess, arrogance that some people can bring to certain reading groups, particularly academic focused. And that's not all of them, but definitely some that I've been part of where it's felt like I can't talk or I can't ask questions because I don't know enough yet. And we just really wanted to create the conditions where people didn't feel like that, that they could say whatever it is that they wanted to say within the limits of respect, and that that's okay and that's the space where they can do that.
Yeah, just taking away, like, any sort of hierarchy or power dynamics between people who are, you know, supposed, like, knowledge holders. I know we've just spoken about institutions and universities, but I did want to return to that space because InPraxis did recently participate in Demilitarize RMIT's series of workshops called Military Industrial Academic Complex, which we spoke about on 3CR Breakfast a few weeks ago. What was it like for you to, you know, everyone to come together in this sort of space and really interrogate how the military industrial complex is growing and evolving within university spaces and coming together with other academics or university workers to try to push back against this?
Yeah, I just want to give a big shout out to the organisers of that event. Like, it was such a great event and it was, from my perspective, one of the first that we've had because of the way that it was uniquely organised and so much effort went into putting that together. So I just want to congratulate them on, I guess, really modelling what it can look like. I know that was a lot of work that went into building that, but what they did was bring together so many different people from so many different backgrounds and areas of work within the academic space, but also outside of it, that the academic context has so much to learn from people that are doing this work outside of universities. And I thought that that was such a good idea. And so it was a really good chance for us to engage with different ways of thinking about this problem that's infiltrating the university context, but also all of the different contexts that exist, all of the different systemic issues entangled in the military-industrial complex. It was just a really great time for us to be able to come together and to also pause for a second and say, what's already out there? What have we done? And where do we go next? Just wanted to congratulate them on bringing that together, because that's kind of the kinds of things that we need to be able to have access to do this kind of work.
Yeah, and I guess following on from that let's talk about the demilitarization resource repository that you're facilitating and asking people to contribute to. I think sometimes it can be quite overwhelming when we're trying to fight against like a monolith, like the military industrial complex. You know, we don't know where to go, where to begin, what to read, what information to access. So can you talk about this repository and, what kinds of documentation you're looking for, and how is it a collective effort?
Yeah, so this resource was actually inspired by the Demilitarized RMIT event, because it was kind of a coming together. And so we thought, well, we should organise a repository of resources that are coming together and that's collectively built. And it's not the first kind of thing to exist. I just really want to acknowledge that. I know there are so many different resource banks and repositories that people have been building across a long period of time. So this is just, I guess, another one of those. And so the idea is for us to have this resource repository that's live and that's continuously updated and built collectively. And so anybody can make a submission to the repository about something that they think should be added. We are not restricted in terms of what resources that can include. It can include articles, radio interviews, podcast episodes, websites, essays, books, documentaries, but even things like flyers, posters, zines, reports, media outputs. We really want to kind of capture all of the different resources that exist out there that are there to deepen our understandings and shape our critical praxis around demilitarisation. And we think that there's just a lot of value in bringing those resources together so that people can easily access them, and that it's collectively built and live as well.
Yeah, and I think, especially at a time when often with mainstream media we see messaging can change quite rapidly, it's so important, I guess, to build a repository and an archive of resources and texts that people can constantly go back to and contribute to, as well, just as like a source that they can rely on when there's just so much other messaging that's going on around us. You said that In Practice started in February 2024. How have you seen, from your perspective, the demilitarization movement evolve in the last couple of years? Do you get a feeling that there is just like a growing movement of people who are starting to, unlearn about the military-industrial complex and how that impacts us? Are you seeing that? I mean, I know there are people who have been fighting against this for a very, very long time. You know, we're talking about First Nations resistance and other collectives and organisations that have been around for a while. But, have you seen a shift in the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think that obviously what the Zionist regime is doing in Palestine has definitely renewed, I guess, our attention and our focus and sharpened it. And it's also, revealed to us, this militarization issue is not new, and our retaliation is also not new. But I think that this has taken many formations and reformations as an issue as well. And I think that what we're noticing is that people are seeing those reformations and these kinds of new ways that it's emerging, and how like the work that we're doing is so wrapped up in it in terms of our daily jobs and the different kinds of ways that we're entangled in these systems of domination. And I think that that's kind of the kind of work that we're noticing is gaining increasing intention from the public, and also just an awareness, a lot of awareness raising that people have become committed to, that the public doesn't have knowledge about this always. And like you said, the mainstream media is not a place that is going to be disseminating this kind of critical knowledge. And so then the community, grassroots, community-led spaces take on that work to to do that work in community to make sure that people are aware of, you know, how complicit the system is and how we're kind of all entrenched in that and what our responsibility is in terms of retaliating.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Nat. And yeah, if there are people out there who have a resource in mind, where can they go to make their contribution?
Yeah, we'd love contributions. It's quite small at the moment because we really want to rely on everyone to build this because we think that that's the most valuable way of doing it. So if you go to our website in praxiscollective.com, there's a resource repositories tab and there's the demilitarisation resource repository link there. And then it'll take you to a form and you can make a submission. But if you have many resources you want to suggest, feel free to just click contact us and let us know. We can find a more accessible way for you to submit several resources.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Nat. And we'll pop all those links in our show notes. But yeah, something, an ongoing topic and issue that, like you said, is very much impacting on our everyday lives and something that requires ongoing discussion and reflection. But yeah, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking to Nat, who was speaking to us about her collective in praxis, as well as the new demilitarization resource repository. If you would like to check out the repository or contribute to it, go to inpraxiscollective.com, and you can also follow them on Instagram at inpraxiscollective. That's I-N-P-R-A-X-I-S collective. We'll be back in just a moment.
G'day, my name is Margie Thorpe. You are listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 on your dial.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast. We're now joined by Matilda Fay, who is an activist and member of Refugee Action Coalition Sydney, and joins us on the show this morning to talk about the Albanese government's first deportation to Nauru under its new secret offshore deal that took place last week, as well as a report on the action that took place outside the Department of Home Affairs in Brisbane last Thursday. Welcome to 3CR, Matilda.
Thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us about the NZYQ cohort, as well as the first deportation that took place last week under the government's new deal with Nauru?
Yeah, sure. So I can give a bit of an outline of the timeline here. So, yeah, we've had, disgracefully first person deported under the new laws just last week. And we've seen, raids on homes by border force, all this kind of thing ramping up. But just to give a bit of the background on the NZYQ High Court case, it was a High Court decision in 2023 that ended in the indefinite detention, so the government's ability to just keep people in detention. And that included, migrants and refugees and people who'd been found to that they couldn't live in the community under character grounds and were being kept indefinitely, which was a disgraceful policy that never should have happened. And, in a correct decision, the High Court ended that. But the government has actually done everything they can since to try and subvert that decision. So that's where we're at now. We had these Trump-style deportation laws passed at the end of 2024 that were effectively the government trying to overturn the NZYQ case and
allow them to deport people for political reasons. So that would allow them to deport them, and if they were being indefinitely detained. So yeah, there's now people who are living in the community who are now being sent, who are now being deported to Nauru. But I think something to emphasise as well is that that law actually affects a much, much wider cohort of refugees and asylum seekers and people, non-citizens, than the government's saying they're going to apply it to. So really, it's sweeping powers that the government has passed here, and we've seen the first of these deportations. But we don't know just how extensive this could be.
Yeah, and that's really quite terrifying there, in terms of the types of powers that the government now holds. We were sort of speaking earlier with Kerry from a public housing collective, talking about, you know, the government always claiming that they don't have money to invest in communities, in healthcare, in education, other things like that, but always have money to invest in prisons and other sort of institutions and things like that. What can you tell us about, you know, the deals that the Australian government has with, not just Nauru, but also with other private contractors to run these detention centres?
Yeah, it's completely a disgrace on the financial side of things. It's, you know, we're talking about eye-watering amounts of money here. So it's a $408 million deal that they've just signed with Nauru. And in that, there's also another $70 million a year for 30 years, and that's supposed to cover the costs of these refugees being kept there. So, it's a disgraceful amount of money. We're talking about, you know, over the lifetime of the deal, about $2.5 billion. So $7 million per person that they're deporting, which it's actually a ridiculous amount of money. And anyone who hears $7 million per person, you know, with what we're facing with the housing crisis at the moment and the underfunding of public housing and public services, we can all think of better uses for that money. And I think it's a clear example of the government being willing to pay for its own political agenda, but not being willing to pay for the services that we need.
And then if we talk about, you know, the conditions in which refugees and asylum seekers are held in Nauru, what can you tell us about, what can you tell about us about the conditions there?
Well, there's this, complete lack of transparency. I mean, they're paying the notorious company MTC for so-called garrison and welfare services, which essentially we've seen the horrific conditions on Nauru in, previous situations with offshore detention, but we don't know actually. We haven't seen what it's going to be like now. And but if the MTC and these kind of companies are anything to go by, absolutely, it's a very terrifying thing. And especially scary is the fact that these laws have actually taken away consideration for people's medical needs or, things like that that could be a case for not deporting them to Nauru. So even in cases where someone might have asthma or something can be demonstrated that it won't be able to be adequately managed in Nauru by MTC, there's no consideration given to that. So they're effectively deporting people to danger, and we could see shocking medical cases, much like what we've seen in offshore detention before.
Definitely. Can you give us a brief report on the protest that happened outside the Department of Home Affairs in Brisbane last week?
Yeah, so I'm based in Sydney, but we Refugee Action Coalition has activist organisations in, you know, Brisbane and Melbourne, and the activists in Brisbane had taken action outside Home Affairs and had, you know, support of a local Greens councillor in that. There was a small action to mark this, I guess, and to say that it is a disgrace and that it hasn't gone unnoticed by the refugee community and refugee organisations. So yeah, that was one small action, but hopefully there will be more, and hopefully you know, with the amount of outrage and fear that this has caused in refugee communities themselves, you know, over the last couple of years we've seen really powerful actions by refugees standing up for their rights to get permanent visas. So yeah, hopefully we will see more action.
Yeah, thank you. And so for listeners out there who would like to get involved or, learn more about what's happening, what would you suggest for them?
So, I'd really encourage people to get involved in many of the anti-racist actions that have been coming, because I think that really ties in with you know, what we're trying to do about the refugee issue. I mean, the refugee campaign usually in every year in March will have a large mobilisation around Palm Sunday in Sydney, and there's similar actions around the country. So that'll be next year. But prior to that, you know, we have got anti-racist actions happening to respond to some of the mobilisations we've seen from the far right. And I think it really ties together, because what we've seen with this NZYQ case and the government's attempts to overturn that is that essentially they're saying that people, just because of their visa status, are somehow more of a danger to the community than any other person who's, you know, been to jail and done their time and then has been released. You know, there's thousands of people every year released from jail, but actually, you know, supposedly we're supposed to be more worried about that. It's more of a threat just because that person is a non-citizen. And I think that's clearly racism. There's no other word for it. And it's racism that's coming directly from the government in this decision. It's a clear case of racism and scapegoating of refugees and asylum seekers and non-citizens. And so I think it'd be great if people can get involved in anti-racist actions around the country.
Yeah, and that's such a great point to make, and making those connections to different movements and different things that are happening in our country, because like you said, it's all interconnected. Thank you so much for joining us on today's program, Matilda.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So that was Matilda Fay, a member of the Refugee Action Coalition in Sydney, speaking about the first deportation of the NZYQ cohort under the government's new secret offshore deal with Nauru. Refugee Action Coalition Victoria are organising a forum to discuss why we need to shut down so-called Australia's offshore detention in Nauru and how we can get organised to push back against racist deportation laws. So that's coming up on Monday, the 17th of November. For more details, you can follow the collective or the coalition at RAC_Victoria on Instagram, or head to their website, which is rac-vic.org. We'll be back with just a wrap up of this morning's program right after this.
Accented women.
It seems so obvious to me that if you live in a completely violent cultural milieu, that it's going to translate into every aspect of women's lives.
Accented women.
What's a border? They don't see it like a big wall right along the
How can country. People live ordinary lives when they're living in such an extraordinary situation where there are armies there and terrorists there and such conflict every single day of their lives?
Accented women.
A show by and about women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds.
On Community Radio 3CR.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. That was just an announcement for Accent of Women, which is coming up next. But first up, we're just going to give you a rundown on what we had on today's show.
Yeah, so first up at 7:15 this morning, we listened to Karen Fletcher and Luisa Bassini speaking at the Standing Together for Public Housing meeting that was held on Thursday, the 23rd of October. And then at 7:30, we listened to Julia speaking to Dr. Lisa Schindler, a marine ecologist working with the Australian Marine Conservation Society, about protecting the Great Barrier Reef from the damaging deforestation that's happening right now.
After that, we were speaking to Kerry Byrne from the Save Public Housing Collective, talking about the ongoing community pickets to save public housing at 12 Holland Court, Flemington. Just another reminder for listeners, that's taking place tomorrow, Thursday and Friday of this week from 7 to 9 a.m. and again from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. We were then joined by Nat from In Praxis Collective, who was speaking to us about their collective, as well as the new demilitarization resource repository that everyone can contribute to. And then finally, we just spoke to Matilda Fay from Refugee Action Coalition Sydney about the first deportation to Nauru from the NZYQ cohort under the federal government's new secret offshore deal with Nauru. That is all we have time for this morning. Thanks so much for joining me this morning, Fiza.
It's good to be here.
Hopefully, everyone has a cozy day. We haven't been outside in a couple of hours, but I'm guessing it's still
raining.
It's still probably still raining.
Yes.
Hope we all have a good week. We'll be back next week on Tuesday, but stay tuned. Accent of Women is coming up next.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.